Why are monsters so much bigger in the dark? You may think that, as the parent of two young children, that this question came my way because of a middle-of-the-night request for a brighter nightlight. But in fact, I was reminded of this uncomfortable reality this past week by someone whose elderly parent was facing intensive surgery and an unclear outcome. An uncertainty for the whole family was lurking around the corner of every conversation. The question does, of course, bring one back to a darkened room late at night where shadows loom and where every creak in the mostly silent house seems to be coming from your closet or from just outside your door or from under your bed. The monsters in the dark rarely have names. J.K. Rowling knew that much when she named Harry Potter's arch nemesis He Who Cannot Be Named. That is part of their power. They live on the edge of the darkness, just on the other side of what can be seen, beyond the grasp of what is held up to the light. One of my ongoing concerns about our contemporary engagement with Holy Scripture is the sanitized manner by which we approach it all too often. After all, the scripture that we read, and often it's what we read and not what we hear, has been imperfectly translated from the ancient Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. And it's translated often into the language that we most often speak. We have given it a most proper name, the Bible. It now has chapters, verses, footnotes, study guides, and it's been packaged for every possible demographic, from teenage girls to born-again seniors. And in the process of being red-lettered and cross-referenced, the sense of strangeness, of difference, of being off-kilter is lost to our contemporary ears as we round off the sharp corners and smooth out the inconsistencies. And then we come across a passage like today's reading from Numbers, which is somewhat strange. The beginning is familiar. The people are complaining. Complaining about God and complaining about Moses. First it was bitter water, then it was no bread, then no water, then no meat, then too much quail. And now these people in misery are beset by fiery serpents in the King James Version, or seraphim in the ancient original Hebrew. So, as usual, after the snakes begin biting, they complain to Moses, and Moses acts as intercessor with God. And once again, God offers Moses a solution. Apparently, the golden statue of a young cow is out, but a bronze snake on a pole is just fine. So whenever someone was bit, they looked at this bronze snake and they would live. As bizarre as this encounter is, I believe that there is great truth here. First, note that God does not take the serpents away as requested. In my life, I have often found that wherever I go, there I am. And like it or not, The snakes seem to be there too. No, what the people were told to do was to look upon that which they feared most in order to live with it. There is truth here. How often, friends, do we turn away from our fears, hoping that if we don't look at them, they will just go away? Or project them onto others so that we don't have to address them within ourselves. Others of us crowd our lives, living at a pace which cannot possibly allow for the kind of space for our fears to enter in. And still others delve into the detail of the detail, immersing ourselves in the minutiae so that what lurks at the edges of the big picture will not be seen. What are those fears? Have you named them, or are they who shall not be named? Is it the fear of a lost job? Is it the fear of the loss of identity? Or the fear of dying alone? Or the fear of debt overtaking your life? Or the fear of the loss of a loved one, a child, or a sibling, or a spouse, or a parent? These fears are real. And this is not to say that these fears are irrational. In fact, there can be some benefit to our fear. But if we sublimate, ignore, crowd out that fear, it simply returns, bubbles up in other, subtler, more destructive ways. And those unspoken fears paralyze us, they distort us, they decreate us in ways that we often at first cannot perceive. It is only after we encounter yet another broken relationship, or hit rock bottom, or that brick wall again, that we realize that there is something deeper, darker at work. For the writer of John's Gospel, the image of Moses lifting up the serpent in the wilderness was not a haphazard allusion to a peculiar encounter in the desert. No, by pointing back to Moses' intercession with the bronze serpent, and by pointing forwards to Christ being lifted on the cross, we are being asked, like the Israelites, we are being asked to gaze upon that which we fear most. In the case of the cross, separation, humiliation, betrayal, suffering, death. But this looking at Jesus being lifted up is not about shame or guilt or continued fear. I fully realize that for centuries, this has indeed been a tactic used by the Christian church for manipulation and control. When this has happened, it has been a perversion of an essential truth. For the lifting up of Jesus was not done so that we might be shamed into relationship or guilted into duty, but remarkably, so that we may be healed. The verses which we heard this morning from John's Gospel are so familiar to so many that they are almost cliché. It's hard to hear them freshly. So you can imagine my surprise and delight when this week, in spending time with this text, I was taught something new. It's found in verse 17. You know the verse after the one that makes all the end zone signs? Verse 17 reads, "Indeed, God did not send the Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through Him." What was opened to me comes at the end of this verse. It turns out that the word that is translated saved is a Greek word often found in the Gospels, sozo. And often, instead of being translated as saved, it is translated as healed, made whole. Listen again. God did not send the Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be healed through Him. Now just imagine that this incarnation, this bodily dwelling of God in the form of Jesus of Nazareth, His confrontations with the powers of His day, His meals shared with many, His presence in the darkened places, His being lifted up on the cross, all was for the healing of the world. What if His willing participation in this crushing, humiliating death was intended to show us that we have nothing to fear? What if this was the integration of that which we fear most, thereby transforming it into our greatest hope? How would this change the way that we live our lives? What kind of light would we shine if instead of asking, "Brother, have you been saved?" instead we asked, "Sister, have you been healed, made whole?" Friends, I don't think I need to tell you that there are many in this church this morning and so many more waiting outside of this church, aching for this sense of healing, of integrated wholeness. Longing to know, to deeply know, that what binds us, what shackles us, what keeps us in darkness can be exposed, lifted up, transformed. For us, it will not be a bronze serpent on a pole. It will not even be a cross that is the extent of our vision. It will be in believing that there is more to the story than an execution and burial. It will be in the promise that wherever two or three are gathered, Christ is present, experienced, and real. It will be in the breaking of the bread and in the remembering around this table. Friends, we are coming close. There are just a few weeks left. As we approach this great mystery, take time. Be quiet. Pay attention. Let that fear be known. Do not push it aside or force it down. Name it. Pick it up, lift it high, so that for once you can see it clearly. And let the light shine upon it.